The relative, incidentally, of Salvador Allende, the democratically elected president of Chile, who was overthrown in a CIA-sponsored coup in 1973. Isabel has lived in the United States now for many years. She wrote recently about fear, and that's what I want to talk to you about. She says it's a very pervasive thing that changes a society and changes the way people behave with each other and changes you from inside. Something breaks inside you. That's a direct quote. Today, in the United States, there's a palpable climate of fear. Masha Gessen, in an op-ed, writes, quote, America's police state has arrived, unquote. People are being picked up off the street with no due process or habeas corpus. Their personal data is being stolen. They are being illegally detained and, in some cases, deported. Talk about fear, its uses, and crucially, how to overcome it.
You know, you can diminish people by fear, and you can lift them up when you break the back of fear. Fear plays an enormously negative role for a culture. It's not just individual, you know, that you and I may individually be afraid of being picked up by a government, or we might individually fear somebody targeting us one way or the other. In fact, when you see on a street a van stop and you see people get out of the van and pull somebody out of a car, throw them into the van and drive off, that corrodes all of society. That's not something that just happened to the person in the car. It's not just the person in the car that is afraid or their family. Everybody who sees that feels fear, feels uncertainty. They don't know what's going on. This corrodes the whole culture. It's not just, you know, even you and I who might see this in real time or even watch a video, it's everybody. If I tell somebody what I saw, they will also feel that their soul corrodes a little bit. So I think the experience of, say, a country like Chile, where fear really crept into the culture and has remained, you know, it hasn't been washed away as the democratic process has come. It remains in the culture. And then the experience of China, where a certain kind of rural fear was cast aside. There may be other kinds of fear people feel, but this rural fear of landlordism and so on was cast aside. You can both have fear imposed on you and you can set it aside. People should not feel that this is a permanent situation. You know, if you struggle against the conditions that impose fear on you, you can actually prevail. And I feel that, for me, David, is precisely the immense spirit of human beings. You know, our capacity to prevail over something like fear, which is a very, very ugly emotion if it sets into the whole culture.
You taught at Trinity College in Connecticut for many years. Now, from your vantage point in Chile, why is Trump going after elite universities like Columbia and Harvard? Students exercising the right of free speech and protest are being suspended and expelled. They're being accused of being anti-Semitic. They're being accused of harming U.S. national interests. Marco Rubio has called protesters lunatics, and he boasts that he has a list of targeted student activists who may have their visas revoked. As a former college professor in the U.S., comment on this situation and the importance of academic freedom.
Yeah, I mean, the first thing to say is that the U.S. far right has for a long time seen colleges, I suppose accurately, as a reservoir of resistance to right-wing activity, resistance also to right-wing thought. This is not a new thing. The attack on, say, multiculturalism, the attack on ethnic studies in Arizona and so on, that part of it is actually quite old. This attempt to subordinate various forms of thought in the academy. I mean, I taught at Trinity on several occasions the Anti-Defamation League, which is not a conventionally far-right organization, would show up on the campus, talk to the president and say that I should be removed from this or that post. In fact, one of the reasons I left the college was I found it exhausting to be constantly under surveillance by these sort of Zionist organizations and right-wing organizations. The right has long decided that college professors and colleges themselves are the reservoir of sort of anti-right-wing discourse. Well, what is new now is the fact that they were proven right. The right was correct that during this genocide in Palestine, tens of thousands of students in U.S. colleges participated in rallies, in boycotts, in sit-ins, in occupations of colleges. And they were saying, stop the genocide. And so now you bring together an older, animosity towards college professors who are teaching ethnic studies and this, that, and the other thing. You bring that antipathy together with a way to try and shut down this protest movement against the genocide in Gaza, and you've got this the perfect opportunity. And that's exactly what's happening. I mean, they're not just arresting student radicals, Palestinians and also non-Palestinians on colleges to shut the protests down. In fact, they're going beyond that. They're talking about diversity, equity, and so on, that all of these programs have to be closed down. That's their earlier anxiety, and they're bringing the two together. I mean, I would like to say that on this, the right wing is actually correct. It is true that universities resisted the rise of the right in a very clear and focused way. Many places did, not everywhere, many places. And it's also true that on U.S. college campuses, the left has a space to operate. The left-wing professors can get jobs, and if they are courageous, they can speak their mind. This is actually true. And the right-wing has decided we are going to shut this down. This has enormous implications for the idea of free speech. But, I would say that people who lack the courage to defend freedom of speech have always been there on U.S. campuses. It's not the first time that this has happened. During the 1950s, during the McCarthyism period, college professors of the left, some communists, some non-communists, some our friends, in a slightly later period, Howard Zinn, for instance, had a hard time getting a job. Noam Chomsky, our friend, has said at many occasions, written about it, said it was easier to be in the sciences because they sort of needed you to teach science, but it was harder in the humanities. They went after a whole generation of people then, and liberal professors didn't defend them. That was the case of the 1950s, and it wasn't just communists. It was gay professors, the so-called Lavender Menace at Smith College, where professors were being fired for being gay. Nobody defended them. I mean, that's the scandal of this, David, that where are the liberals? When are they going to be outraged on the campus to defend students, to defend their own presidents, who from the very beginning were being run out of town? And by the way, the attack on college presidents preceded the attack on the colleges and the money. And who defended these presidents? Nobody. You don't defend against the first attack, you're vulnerable to lose every single one of them.
Among those groups monitoring the academy would be Campus Watch, Beter, and the Canary Mission. May 15th marked the Nakba, the Arabic word for catastrophe. It refers to the forced expulsion and ethnic cleansing of 750,000 Palestinians from their homes and lands in 1948. Here we are, 77 years later, with Palestinians enduring another Nakba. The organization Canadians for Justice and Peace in the Middle East says the Nakba never ended. We've run out of words to describe the horror that is Gaza and increasingly the West Bank. Genocide is being live streamed as the so-called civilized world watches. Israel's war on Gaza persists unabated, aided and abetted with U.S. weapons and tax dollars and diplomatic cover in international fora. Amnesty International, in its annual State of the World's Human Rights Report, writes, Israel committed genocide in Gaza, including by causing some of the highest known death tolls among children, journalists, and health and humanitarian workers of any recent conflict in the world, and deliberately inflicting on Palestinians conditions calculated to bring about their physical destruction. There was very little coverage of the Amnesty report. One can only imagine if the report was on Iran or Russia, let's say, what the response would be. Your comments.
Obviously, David, you know, it's been sickening just to watch this particular bombardment of Gaza. I mean, you know, you and I have observed and reported on and tracked the violence inflicted on the Palestinians for a very long time, but I would say that this is qualitatively different. This is just really brutal. You know, there is a permanent Nakba. There is a permanent understanding that the Palestinians must either be removed from what is known by the Israelis as Judea and Samaria, the entire region on the western side of the Jordan River, going all the way to Egypt. In fact, some Israelis want to go beyond the Jordan River into Jordan, but even further to Iraq. I've seen a map now showing Israel claiming the whole of Jordan. At any rate, Ilyas said, one, Palestinians have to leave. They have to be expelled. That's one proposal. Or the second is that they remain, but they remain subordinated and as second-class citizens. That's the permanent Nakba. That is, in fact, what the Israeli authorities have wanted since 1948, and it has been unchanged. I mean, you know, we should not underestimate what the Israelis have been doing on the West Bank during this period. Again, coming in, bulldozing houses and so on. They've actually, by now, effectively taken over Jerusalem. And so, given this permanent Nakba situation, my opinion, and I know what you were saying about, you know, Russia or Iran, if the Amnesty report had been about those regions, this is not just about geopolitics. This is also reflective of an international division of humanity. You know, some people are seen as human and some people are not. You know, the Ukrainians are given title to full humanity, Palestinians not. They are not seen as human. And I think this is a very old colonial understanding of the world, this international division of humanity. Some people human, some people not human.
The Israeli attitude seems to be toward the Palestinians, let them go somewhere else. The Israeli outlet Maariv in mid-May reports Netanyahu saying about Gaza, I'm quoting here, "We are demolishing more and more homes. They have nowhere to return to. The only natural outcome will be a desire among Gazans to emigrate. Our main problem," Netanyahu is quoted as saying, "is finding countries willing to take them," unquote. That kind of lays out the grand strategy that the Israeli government has for the Palestinians. You know, during the post-George Floyd uprisings in the United States, there was the slogan, Black Lives Matter. Do Palestinian lives matter? You seem to suggest that they don't in the kind of configuration of power.
Well, the first thing, I mean, I think needs to be said, even though it may be obvious to many of your listeners, is that what Mr. Netanyahu says is a war crime. Just what he said, you know, in that quotation. This idea that you forcibly remove people, displace people, is a war crime. Let me explain that for a minute. Firstly, it is settled international law that Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem are part of the occupied Palestinian territory. This happened in 1967. It's settled international law. That's why in international documents, these areas are referred to as the occupied Palestinian territory. It is also established international law that when a military power occupies a territory, they cannot transfer population. In the Geneva Conventions, that is called population transfer. Population transfer is a war crime. What Mr. Netanyahu has just said is he says that we are creating the conditions for population transfer in an occupied territory. Just for that, he needs to go to prison. Just for that statement. I mean, you don't need any more. That statement plus the behavior of the Israeli state bulldozing northern Gaza demonstrates an active war crime. We are seeing a war crime in real time. Are Palestinians treated as humans? Of course not. Of course not. By whom? I mean, in the United States, young Palestinian students stand up and say, I think what's happening in Palestine is outrageous. Some of them go to prison. In Israel, a Palestinian posts on Facebook, a Palestinian who lives within the 1948 lines in Israel, a Palestinian posts on Facebook, I am outraged by the violence against Palestinians in Gaza. They are arrested and sent to jail. There's a number of examples of this. That means that neither in the United States nor in Israel are Palestinians seen as human beings, because you cannot say that Palestinians are being treated as less than human. How can you say they are being treated as less than human if they are not less than human? This may sound like some sort of philosophical gobbledygook to somebody, but trust me, give me a whiteboard or a blackboard, I can diagram this for you. The logic of arresting a person, anybody, in fact, not just a Palestinian, but even worse if it's a Palestinian, for saying that Palestinians are being treated as less than human is a sign that you don't believe that they are less than human.
To what extent does Islamophobia and Orientalism factor in how Palestinians, Arabs, Muslims, the East writ large are seen? Though when it comes to money-loaded feudal sheikhs, sultans, and emirs, there's no shortage of admiration and adulation from the Trump regime.
I actually have been reconsidering some of these concepts, Islamophobia and Orientalism. And I think it's okay to reconsider them. I think Edward Said, who you and I both knew, would say, well, let's have a conversation about it. I don't think he would be upset by it. I'm reconsidering it, and your question also suggests that you're thinking about it. Because I think that more than a fear of Islam or more than hatred of the East, there is certainly in the world we live in now a deep hatred of anybody who's standing up or trying to change the world order where the West used to be dominant. As the West is slipping from a position of almost absolute power, it is lashing out against anybody who is not willing to subordinate themselves to the West. Very interesting. The Prime Minister of Italy, Maloney, traveled to Albania. And the Albanian head of government, I've forgotten whether he's the prime minister or the president, got down on one knee to greet her. And I thought, oh, that's so perfect. You know, the East subordinating itself to the West. As long as you subordinate yourself, you drop to your knee. You know, he was there like as if he was asking her to marry him or a knight waiting to be knighted. You know, utter subordination, submission to power. Unless you submit to power, like, you know, the Arab regimes have been doing. Mr. Trump, please take this aircraft. It's a gift from us, the Qataris say. I mean, it's a ridiculous attempt at currying favor. Unless you do that, then we hate you. We hate the Chinese. Why? Why does the West hate the Chinese? Because the Chinese are saying, look, we are not going to bend our knee to you. You know, we are not going to surrender our development growth. You're going to sanction us. Well, okay, go ahead and put tariffs. We're going to build our own thing. We'll trade with somebody else. They hate the Palestinians because the Palestinians say, we are not going to subordinate ourselves to Israeli power. We want to build our own world. You know, they hate the Cubans because the Cubans say, we are not going to subordinate ourselves. Venezuelans, we're not going to subordinate ourselves. All these people, that effectively say we want to build sovereignty, and now they are joined by the Burkinabe people in Burkina Faso, they are joined by the Malians, by the people of Niger, all saying we want to build our own world, we don't want to subordinate ourselves. Well, look, here come the coup d'etats. I mean, you are going to face violence as if you don't get on your knees, except the problem is the West no longer has the capacity to permanently put down the million mutinies. And there are a million mutinies now. There are. They just can't put them down. You know, they can't, because it's like whack-a-mole. You whack somebody here, somebody else appears. Why? Because the world is changing. Western power is no longer going to be eternal or feel like it's eternal. And so, yeah, I think that it's true that Islamophobia is real and it does exist in many places, including within the United States. But I just don't think this is the best lens to understand what's happening either in Palestine or, you know, against the Chinese, against the Burkinabe people. I just don't think this lens effectively gets it. I think the stronger lens is that the West is declining and it's unwilling and unable to accept countries exercising their sovereignty.
The Gaza genocide has created some openings, some apertures. Automatic support for Israeli policies simply ain't what it used to be. There have been demonstrations across the U.S., Canada, and around the world, maybe even in Chile, which has a large Palestinian diaspora and population. Diaspora Jewish organizations such as Jewish Voice for Peace, If Not Now, and other groups have not only participated but have led protests. Within Israel, there's B'Tselem, Standing Together, and Breaking the Silence. The latter is an organization of former soldiers against the Gaza War. Its director, Avner Gevaryahu, has said Netanyahu's government is drunk on revenge. Another dissident voice inside Israel is Ami Ayalon, former Israeli Navy Commander-in-Chief, Director of Shin Bet, Israel's domestic intelligence service. He warned, quoting, "Continuing the occupation is the single greatest threat to Israel's safety and to our existence as a democracy." He predicted that Israel's continued settlement expansion and preventing an independent Palestinian state, I'm quoting again, will isolate Israel, increase anti-Semitism, and be the end of Israel as the founding fathers of Zionism envisioned it, unquote. So there is, you know, rising animosity toward what Israeli state policies are.
Yes, that's true. But I'm not sure if I want to accept this as a major change. You know, ever since the 67 war, there has been a current within Israel that has been very much opposed to militarism, to the militarization of Israel, in fact. There's been a current. There have been lots of liberal voices that have been there, you know, for a very long time. I'm not sure that they have the kind of impact that they need to have. And I think that's a problem. I think that the settler movement, for instance, the settlers in the West Bank, the settlers who want to go back and resettle Gaza and so on, I think they have an enormous megaphone. I think that the new right that has emerged in Israel, made of people who've migrated there over the last 20 years or so, this is not the old Ashkenazi elite, you know, which incubated a kind of liberalism, a kind of sort of, you know, European civilization liberalism. This is not that crowd. These are people with different obligations, different ideas. You know, when they came into Israel from Russia and other places, they went straight into the settlements, many of them, and that's their worldview. And those settler parties, I think, have an enormous role to play in the Knesset, in Israeli culture. So I don't feel too confident that within Israel there can be a new dispensation breaking out. I just don't see it. I mean, all the people who emerge as an opposition to Mr. Netanyahu, end up actually being, party to one or the other conflict. I mean, look at the cabinet that was set up after October 7th. Everybody sort of joined in, and even when they broke away saying he's conducting the war badly. You know, that was the general sense of people who broke from Netanyahu. They said he's doing the war badly. Not that this war is objectionable. There are lots of good voices of conscience. I don't want to minimize that. And it's extremely important to have these voices of conscience within Israel. But I also don't want to exaggerate their role in Israeli society. I think that would be an error for us. Now, when you talk about the world and the protests going on around the world, one of the things that's important to recognize that in some countries, in Turkey, in Indonesia and so on, they see this as part of Muslim solidarity. So there's a kind of limited understanding of the Palestinian struggle, national liberation and so on. But still, millions of people out on the street. I think I would like to register the fact that still within the non-aligned movement, even in the BRICS bloc, and this has had an impact on the right-wing government in India, in the BRICS bloc as well, some old ideas of Palestine as a unfinished anti-colonial struggle resonate. I mean, just in mid-May of this year, the Chinese foreign ministry said that, Gaza is part of Palestine, it should not be touched, and so on. The fact that the BRICS has taken a position which emanates from the residues of the kind of, anti-colonial view of this struggle has actually hampered Mr. Modi in India. Mr. Modi hasn't been able to fly to Tel Aviv and stand with his friend Netanyahu. Mr. Modi hasn't been able to say, that India is with Israel. Mr. Modi himself has not been able to do that. Equally, even though the Indian businesses have been selling weapons continually to Israel right through this conflict, the government hasn't been able to openly trade with Israel, with like great open fanfare. Things are happening in a clandestine way. And I think that is very interesting and important, that even a country like India is sort of held back by the BRICS consensus. I've never, ever said the BRICS is like the future of the world, okay? But it is an opening. And I want to just register this, that within the BRICS countries, they continue to take this position. And it's really important that right through this conflict, both India and China have said that the two-state solution must not be annulled. Now, I know, David, that you probably had lots of people on the program criticizing the two-state solution. I also think the two-state solution on the ground has been basically annulled. But it's still important for major powers in the world to hold fast to the two-state solution, because if you say that the two-state solution is done, then the Israelis can annex East Jerusalem, West Bank, and Gaza without any resistance. Right now, when China says the two-state solution must be respected, what they are saying is you cannot annex Gaza, you cannot annex the West Bank. So we need to understand these things diplomatically and contextually. In context, the two-state solution is not realistic and viable. But when they are saying it, it's about an anti-annexation view, which I think is very important to maintain. And I think even though these voices of conscience in Israel say the same thing, they are also saying don't annex Gaza, their ability to actually reach large numbers of people is hampered. It's much restricted. Whereas, when the Chinese government says it, it has an impact because it then influences the Indian foreign ministry, the South African foreign ministry, and so on. Everybody then repeats that. And I think that's very significant, because they are not going to permit the annexation, or at least they're going to try their best not to.
You're listening to Vijay Prashad. Is the Nakba permanent? This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977 or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. October 7th, no context for it or other Palestinian attacks. The occupation and annexationist policies are never mentioned. To explain and give background and history is not to condone acts of violence. For example, it might be helpful for people to know that Gaza has been under an Israeli blockade since 2007, or that many thousands of Palestinians are in jail, held without charges, or that demolition of homes is collective punishment, or that there are now more than 750,000 settlers in the West Bank. So this goes to the heart of what is called media coverage or lack of coverage.
Everybody must feel for civilians. You know, civilians, when they are taken, whether as hostages or whatnot, it's a very scary thing and it shouldn't happen to anybody. But I also want to emphasize that in a way, all of Gaza is under hostage situation. You know, people just can't go anywhere. They can't travel. They can barely get anything. They are within a kind of large prison compound. Even though Palestinians have built a lot of joy inside Gaza before the bombardment, it's still an enclosed space. Part of Oslo II was to allow the Palestinians of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza free access to each other. That was never permitted. You know, there's no free access for the Palestinians in the occupied territories. Obviously, these forms of violence or these forms of fighting are going to take place. A few years ago, the Palestinians attempted a peaceful march to the perimeter fence. They were slaughtered. You know, that annuls peaceful protests. Then you think, why should we do peace? Why should we be, you know, fish in a bucket? We're going to now go and get hostages. I mean, I can see the logic of this. It's not illogical. If you look at how those peaceful marchers were sniped and killed and the eyes taken out and so on, it does leave you with an idea that this nonviolent strategy is not going to work. You know, people who say, why don't the Palestinians do something nonviolent? Well, every time they've tried a nonviolent something, they've been brutally attacked. So you try something like this.
Now, again, to Nakba then and now. In Gaza, people are starving to death, says Oxfam. Save the Children says every child is now at risk of famine. Marco Rubio, who spends a lot of time chasing students who say things that he doesn't like, commanded by his president, he has said that the U.S. is, quote, troubled by the humanitarian situation in Gaza. How about that? Troubled. Asked by the BBC if the Trump administration remained fully behind the nature of Israel's military action, he once again called on Hamas to surrender and release hostages and said there could be no peace so long as the group exists. What do you think about our esteemed Secretary of State and his saying that he's troubled by the deaths of tens of thousands and the wounding of many more and the destruction that has been wreaked?
Now, I'm glad that Mr. Rubio, or Secretary Rubio, has made the comment saying that he's concerned. And I think we should take what we get. I mean, I'm actually very happy to hear that he is concerned, which means that there is some humanity in him. And I'd like to appeal to that humanity. And I would like to say to him that, look, you say the people of Gaza, but at least you can name them. They are Palestinians. That would be helpful. That they are Palestinian people and that they have been struggling actually to exercise their humanity. And also that Hamas is merely one of many, resistance factions that are trying to defend and assist the Palestinians to attain freedom. They're not the only one. You know, Mr. Netanyahu well knows that if Hamas is destroyed today, another group is going to appear tomorrow. You know, they weakened Fatah. They weakened Fatah deeply, and the space was filled by Hamas. You know, Hamas weakened now, the space will be filled by somebody else. Years ago, while he was walking on his treadmill, Khalid Mishal gave an interview where he said that, look, if you think Hamas is a dangerous organization, you don't know what's coming next. You know, what he meant was that these cycles of violence produce their opposition. You know, and a cycle of submission also produces its opposition. You know, right now, the Kurdish Workers' Party has decided to end its armed struggle. Yeah, in front of the Turkish state. They have decided the PKK, the armed struggle is over. But now the onus is on the Turkish state. Will they accept the Kurds as full-fledged citizens of Turkey? Will they allow the Kurdish language to be spoken? Will they no longer discriminate against the 1 million Kurds who work and live in Istanbul, more than 1 million? If they don't do that, a new PKK will emerge. You know, it's not that the PKK was some residue of the past. It's actually it's a condition of the present. You know, the reason why the FARC, the revolutionary armed group in Colombia, decided to set down weapons at the Havana Agreement was because they anticipated and saw a political way forward. They now have a political party in Colombia called Commune, and they feel like the current government of Gustavo Petro is taking some of the questions of land reform pretty seriously. So they decided to end the armed struggle. I mean, there are plenty of examples of armed struggles ending. But the armed struggle by Hamas or by the Palestinians is only going to end when the occupation of the Palestinian ends. That's it. They are not going to surrender before the occupation ends. And so that is something that the Israelis are well aware of. It's not rocket science. And all the examples of a proper ending of an armed struggle is either when the armed struggle prevails, that's the example of the Chinese Revolution in 1949, or the Cuban Revolution of 1959, or if the armed struggle is destroyed completely, that's the example of Guatemala, for instance, where the armed struggle was completely destroyed, or where the armed struggle ends because the ruling elites decide to incorporate the demands of the armed struggle and then there's a peaceful transfer. Example there, again, being Colombia, to some extent being Nepal, where the armed struggle morphs, allows political parties to develop. And let's see what happens in Turkey. We don't know. The announcement has just come. So there is no evidence in world history of an armed struggle, let's say the Palestinian struggle, being shut down because a big power has told them to stop doing it. It would effectively, in the conditions right now, be a surrender. I don't think the Palestinians are willing to surrender.
Respond, if you can decode a couple of mantras that Israeli officials intone time and time again. One is that, yes, there are civilian casualties among the Palestinians. That's because Hamas is using them as human shields. That's certainly one common trope. Another one is that any country that is attacked has the right to self-defense.
Yeah, let's take the second one first, that any country that's attacked has the right to self-defense. That's actually true. Any country that's attacked by international law has the right to self-defense. There's no question about that. That's absolutely true. The only difference is that Israel is a country, but it's not being attacked by another country. And that's a key factor. If Israel was attacked by, let's say, Syria, or if Israel was attacked by Jordan, then Israel has a right to defend itself. But when you are occupying a people, when you have a military occupation of a people, in fact, it is not your self-defense that's paramount, but the paramount international obligation is that the people who are being occupied have the right to fight with any means against the occupation to end the occupation. So in fact, the prior right is not with Israel. The prior right is with the occupied party, which has a right to defend itself against the occupation by any means. So in fact, what the Israelis say in abstraction is correct, that a country has a right to defend itself. But when it comes to the specific situation of the Palestinians and Israelis, the prior right is not with the Israelis. The prior right is with the Palestinians, who have a right by any means to fight against their occupation. So that's the second statement. The first is actually quite interesting. And Gaza is a super congested area when you look at the cities. So you could sit in a rural part of Gaza and fire rockets, but then you're a sitting duck. you know, if you enter a city and attempt to do guerrilla warfare from Gaza City or from Khan Yunis, there is no space there for you to create a military zone, you know, from which to fire. And in fact, the Israelis are completely hypocritical about this, because in Tel Aviv, they've built their Shin Bet headquarters, their military headquarters, in the middle of residential areas. So when Hezbollah fires rockets at them, they say, oh my God, you've hit a civilian area. They built purposefully, I think, these headquarters in civilian areas. Also, I would grant that in Israel, a very congested society, you may have built something in a slightly remote area and housing has crept in. You know what our cultures are like. There are housing laws and nobody listens to them and they just keep building. They bribe some lower official. Next thing you learn, there's a protected military zone and there's a big multi-story building overlooking it, you know, and looking into the military base, which is a protected zone. This has happened. I've seen it in Haryana. Anyway, there is no way for Palestinians to fire things into Israel or to live anywhere or to hide anywhere without being surrounded by civilians. To say that the Palestinian fighters are using civilians as shields is, I think, ludicrous, if you understand what Gaza is like. Secondly, these statements that they are building tunnels under hospitals and so on has been proven to be ridiculous. I mean, the show of cameras going underneath the hospital and showing whatever tunnel. I mean, it didn't prove anything. It didn't prove that there was military arsenal there. In fact, the Israelis now are bombing makeshift hospitals almost deliberately. I mean, I don't know. I can't say deliberately because I don't get their statement saying we are going to bomb a hospital. The evidence suggests that they are deliberately bombing residences and hospitals and schools and universities. Why did the Israelis, having captured sections of Gaza City, then put explosives on the university, on Gaza, the Islamic University of Gaza, and demolish it? Why? They were right there. They could have gone down, checked tunnels, whatever. No, they deliberately demolished the university. That, to me, is academicide, you know, that kind of thing is open, and they filmed it and celebrated it. Using Palestinians as human shields, I don't think that sits well with me. It's not true. I don't think they are deliberately saying we are willing to sacrifice, you know, our people in order for some, you know, hiding behind. I mean, these are pretty courageous people.
The political landscape in the Middle East has dramatically changed. Trump went on a sales trip to those great democracies, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and the United Arab Emirates. Israel has seemingly, and I'm qualifying that, seemingly emerged as the regional hegemonic power. It has smashed Hamas, it routed Hezbollah in Lebanon, it weakened Iran. The fall of the Assad regime in Syria in December was a huge blow to Iran. Israel continues to occupy and bomb parts of Syria and Lebanon. It bombs in retaliation the Houthis in Yemen. U.S. sanctions on Syria have been lifted. And as you mentioned, after some 40 years, the PKK, the Kurdish movement, has given up armed struggle against the Turkish state. So what are your views on this seemingly changed landscape?
This seemingly changed landscape has been changing for a long time. I don't think we should see it as an immediate thing. I mean, we've got to go back to the first biggest blow, biggest change in the Middle East that occurred, which occurred in 1979, and that was Camp David, when the Egyptians decided to sign a peace agreement with the Israelis. That was the first break, I think, amongst the regional countries vis-a-vis what Israel had achieved in 1948. I mean, people need to recognize that the British, firstly, when they left both the Levant area, the British mandate in the Levant, and when they left the British Raj in India, they very callously left by trying to partition the areas and just leave it at that. I mean, in British India, the partition of the subcontinent, the Radcliffe lines, resulted in the death of 1 million people at least, and 13 million people were displaced, including my family, displaced from Lahore into northern India and so on. I mean, this was a catastrophe of its own kind. 1 million people died. I mean, I just don't think people around the world know that how this devastation occurred. The birth of India and Pakistan was traumatic. Both countries went into a war in 1948. The same was in the Levant. I mean, the British just sort of made a line in the sand and said, this is the partition. This is going to be Palestine. This is going to be the new Jewish state. And this is our British settlement over the mandate as we leave. And of course, the Israelis didn't honor the British partition, and they seized everything except roughly 20% or so that was Gaza, the West Bank, and East Jerusalem. That's because the Jordanian armies had come and taken the West Bank and East Jerusalem, and the Egyptians came and took Gaza, and that's where the refugees were settled, except those that went outside the region or went to Jordan and Lebanon. So these are twin processes of the harm that British imperialism has done in both the subcontinent and in the Levant region, in Palestine. So this is a completely different story of displacement, of anger, and so on. And this then magnified over the years, you know, as one, two, three generations, four, five generations don't get justice. It magnified over the years, the sense of deep injustice. And the roots of that deep injustice never went away. You know, at a certain point, the Fatah group in the Palestinian Liberation Organization said, okay, we'll just take the 20-odd percent that was left, the West Bank, Gaza, and East Jerusalem. Even that was not acceptable. The Israelis built settlements. They simply didn't allow and honor Oslo II, which was really a surrender. It's what Edward Said called the Palestinian Versailles, a surrender. They never even accepted that. They wanted everything. They kept talking about Judea and Samaria. They wouldn't even accept a word called Palestinian. They said even that doesn't exist, you know. So this particular genocidal act against the Palestinians is really just a qualitative increase in violence to get the Palestinians out of Palestine.
Years ago, Arundhati Roy, the great Indian writer, said, another world is possible. I haven't talked with her recently. I wonder if she still feels optimistic, given the genocide in Gaza, mass killings in Sudan, the Congo, and Myanmar, to terminal war dangers in South Asia, to a planet getting hotter and hotter, and extreme weather events become more and more frequent. How do we get to a more peaceful world?
I love Arundhati. I love her writings. I love her as a person. I don't agree with that slogan. I didn't agree then. I don't agree now. Because it's a non-specific slogan. Of course, another world is possible. Even fascism is possible. You know, anything is possible. I don't agree. It's too non-specific. The real slogan is socialism is necessary, David. That for me is the real slogan. It's not another. It's socialism is necessary. I mean, the capitalist system has shown itself to be brutal, have utter disregard for humanity and for nature. Let's just pack it in and let capitalism ruin everything. You know, let's allow Elon Musk to blow the world up and fly off to Mars as he watches in the rearview mirror a big convulsion happening here. Okay, let's give it up. I don't agree. I think we fight it. And we fight it not to build a better, more humane capitalism, because I don't think that's possible. I think we fight it to build socialism. I might be a romantic idiot or whatever. Somebody may want to call me out of touch with reality. I don't care. All signs show that this system cannot solve itself. All signs show that. There's hundreds of millions of people around the world who are aching for something different. We have to give them something specific, a utopia. Call it whatever you will. You don't want to call it socialism? Fine. Call it whatever you will. We need to build another world where people are able to live with dignity and they are able to live with nature, taking some of the fruits of nature, but not destroying nature. That's what we need. I call that socialism. You can call it whatever you want. It's the same thing. We need to get out of this. Elon Musk cannot be allowed to blow this up. We need to build something that is better, and I call that socialism. So I say socialism is necessary.
Finally, what gives you hope? What keeps you going?
I mean, look, partly it's kind of stubbornness. You know, I mean, just can't give it up. You know, it's going to get better. It's partly that. It's partly every single poet I've ever read. You know, poetry, even the bleakest poetry, always has some sort of horizon, you know, where there's some light shining somewhere. Faiz Ahmed Faiz, our great, you know, star in the sky. Faiz Ahmed Faiz, you know, wrote poetry in prison, which is, you know, says that the door will always open, you know, the cage will always open. And I breathe that every day. You know, I believe that the door will open, the cage will open. You can't live like this forever. The human spirit, and I believe there's such a thing, the human spirit cannot be exhausted. You know, it continues to flourish. Look at Leonard Peltier, so many years illegally in jail, walks out, breathes the air and says beautiful things. He's not bitter, he's not angry. He's looking forward to building a new world. Take inspiration from those stories, David. People who continue to feel that part of the human spirit that just cannot be exhausted.
Thanks very much for your time.
Thanks a lot, David.
You were just listening to Vijay Prashad, Is the Nakba Permanent? I talked with him in mid-May. Vijay Prashad is an internationally renowned historian and journalist. He's the author of many books, including Washington Bullets, CIA Coups and Assassinations. This program is produced by Alternative Radio, based in Boulder, Colorado. We're an independent nonprofit in our 39th year. We're supported solely by individuals just like you. We feature such voices as Chris Hedges, Naomi Klein, Gabor Mate, Roxanne Dunbar-Ortiz, and Noam Chomsky. And we have a series of Vijay Prashad programs. To access our complete audio and book catalog, just go to our website, alternativeradio.org. Again, our website where we are podcasting, alternativeradio.org. For copies of today's program, Vijay Prashad, Is the Nakba Permanent? And for Vijay Prashad's classic book, Washington Bullets, CIA Coups and Assassinations, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org. That's alternativeradio.org. Printed transcripts, PDFs, and MP3s of this program are free of charge. To get them, just call us, 1-800-444-1977. Special thanks to KGNU. Joe Rich is our general manager and editor. I'm David Barsamyan. Thank you for listening. We go out with Indian sitar maestro Vilayat Khan performing Raga Sohini.
Mom and Dad used to argue about everything, especially about Dad's drinking. My family went from totally crazy to quiet, calm, and even peaceful when Mom started going to Al-Anon family groups. I wanted a better relationship with Dad, so I asked Mom if she would take me to her Al-Anon meetings or to Alateen. I'm sure glad I did. Is someone's drinking troubling you? You might be surprised at what you can learn in an Al-Anon or Alateen family group from people just like you. Call 1-888-4-ALANON or go to alanon.org.
Hello, my fellow Americans. I would just like to say now, as an expert on the subject, that WRCT Pittsburgh does not blow. Thank you.
You are listening to WRCT Pittsburgh, and this is Ebony Spectrum. WRCT.org.
People standing, the kids that popped up that decided to visit us, we're so happy that you all are here. Everyone is welcome in this space. We are island people. If I had a chance, I would be grounding below a tree, but instead I'm here, right? And so everybody, just be as comfortable as you can. The turnout is just a reflection of the importance of this day. We're truly happy that you all are here. And so we're gonna run into the program right away to get things started and going. So I would like to invite the president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, Dr. Ron Daniels, to give us some opening remarks and to tell us about the solemnity of the occasion. Dr. D.
Good afternoon, Grenada. Good afternoon, Grenada. My name is Dr. Ron Daniels. I'm president of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century. And we have assembled a powerful delegation. All the delegation that have arrived. Raise your hands. Raise your hands. Raise your hands. These are people who have come from all over to be with you today. We are here on this location where the mother of Malcolm X, a warrior woman whose name is Louise Langdon Little, we're here to celebrate her on the eve of the 100th birthday of one of the greatest freedom fighters of all time, El Haj Malik El Shabazz Omawale, our black shiny prince, Malcolm X. We want to offer our thanks and our praise to Terrence Wilson. Where's Mr. Wilson? To Terrence Wilson. Yes, sir.
Of Dr. Garvey, who is actually the son of Marcus Garvey. Give him a round of applause for us, please. So as we celebrate the remarkable life of Louise Langdon Little, an activist and fighter, to pay tribute to another outstanding woman, a mother who lost her husband in the struggle in 1973, and 10 years later, lost her son, the last revolutionary prime minister of Grenada, the woman who gave us Morris Bishop. I would like us to recognize Ali Menta Bishop, the mother of Morris Bishop. One of the shortcomings of us as black people is a failure to promote and protect our history. But were it not for one gentleman, a gentleman who has jealously guarded this property here, a gentleman who in his own right is a descendant of Louise Little and Malcolm X, and who over the years single-handedly has done everything he could to preserve that history of Louise Little. I remember when we came here for the first time with Dr. Daniels, we had a little trouble finding the place, and when we finally found it, we were at the bottom side, and we actually saw a sign saying no trespassing, but we took the liberty to trespass a little bit. And in no time at all, we saw this angry man come up and said, "Do you know that you are trespassing?" And when we explained to him who we were, and that this is Dr. Daniels from the Black World Institute, that anger just turned into love and togetherness. That gentleman has preserved this history right here. He has become the watchdog of the history of Lewis Langdon Little. And he has defended the space in a way that nobody has, so that today all of us can come here to celebrate the groundbreaking ceremony for the monument that is going to be laid here for Lewis Langdon Little. He will be the curator of this monument and also this project over the years. I have great pleasure in introducing to you Brother Terrence Wilson.
Pleasant greetings to everyone, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, ministers of government, and everyone, distinguished everybody. We are happy to be here because of this family project here. And we are most grateful for the International Black Wall and all the other organizations who have stood behind us solidly to give us that support that can move this project forward with success. We also thank the government, opposition, everyone for giving the support for what we are doing here. We have the t-shirt selling, trying to do little things. We are happy, and I must say, we are so happy. I don't want to spoil your time here. I want every one of you from the United States to have the opportunity to share with us and to dish out some historical food with us. So without any delay, we have the families here, bloodline families here. A lot of them are here, right up there. Then we have a Malcolm X Family Foundation, which we have in place. We have a manifesto and everything in support of what we are doing. So without further delay, I would just like to mention Sister Poland Patterson, Dr. Daniel, and everyone else who have